Nobuhiko left his father with his mind whirling. Set Humphreys and Asro against each other. Yes, he decided, it would be in Yamagata Corporation's best interest to do so, and this exile Fuchs could be the pivot that moves the stone. By the time he landed in the family's estate near New Kyoto, Nobuhiko was lost in admiration for the depth of his father's thought. A war between HSS and Astro. Nobu smiled. Living in a monastery hasn't softened the old man's heart. Or his brain. Habitat Chrysalis. Originally, the prospectors and miners who came out to the belt lived inside the largest of the asteroids, Ceres. Honeycombed by nature with lava tubes and caves, Ceres offered solid rock protection against the hard radiation that constantly sleets through the solar system. But at less than half the size of Earth's moon, the asteroid's minuscule gravity presented problems for long-term residents. Muscle and bone deteriorate in microgravity, and every movement in the asteroid's caves and tunnels, every footfall or hand's brush against a rock wall, stirred up fine, powdery, carbon-dark dust that lingered in the air, hovering constantly in the light gravity. The dust was everywhere. It irritated the lungs and made people cough. It settled in fine black coatings on dishes in cupboards, on furniture, on clothing hanging limply in closets. It was Lars Fuchs who had started the ramshackle habitat that eventually was named Chrysalis by the rock rats. When he lived in Ceres with his wife, Amanda, before he was exiled and she divorced him to marry Humphreys, Fuchs got his fellow rock rats to start building the habitat. All the rock rats knew that Fuchs's real motive was to start a family. A habitat in orbit around Ceres rotating to produce an artificial gravity would be a much safer place to have babies. So they started buying stripped-down spacecraft and old junkers that had been abandoned by their owners. They connected them, tinker toy fashion, and slowly built a wheeled station in orbit around Ceres that could house the growing population of rock rats. It looked like a rotating junkyard from the outside, but its interior was clean, efficient, and protected by the electromagnetic radiation shields that each individual ship had built into it. By the time the residents of Ceres moved to their orbital habitat and named it Chrysalis, Fuchs had lost his one-man war against Humphrey's space systems, been exiled from the habitat he himself had originated, and lost his wife to Martin Humphreys. Big George Ambrose was thinking about that sad history while his torch ship approached Ceres. As he packed his toiletries in preparation for docking, he cast an eye at the wall screen view of the habitat. Chrysalis was growing. A new ring was being built around the original circular collection of spacecraft. The new ring looked more like a proper habitat. The rock rats had enough money now to invest in real engineering, and the same quality of construction that went into the space habitats in the Earth-Moon region. "One day we'll abandon the old clunker," George told himself, surprised at how rueful he felt about it. "It's been a good home." The big, shaggy, bearded, red-headed Aussie had started his career as an engineer at Moonbase, long before it became the independent nation of Cellini. He had lost his job in one of the economic wobbles of those early days, and became a fugitive, a non-person who lived by his wits in the shadowy black market of the lunar underground. Then he'd run into Dan Randolph, who made George respectable again. By the time Randolph died, George was a rock rat, plying the dark and lonely expanse of the belt in search of a fortune. Eventually, he was elected chief administrator of Ceres. Now he was returning home from Humphrey's winter solstice party. He had spent the 6 days of his return voyage in a liaison with the torch ship's propulsion engineer, a delightful young Vietnamese woman of extraordinary beauty, who talked about fusion rocket systems between passionate bouts of lovemaking. George had been flabbergasted by the unexpected affair, until he realized that she wanted a position on a prospecting ship, and the fling with the chief of the Rock Rats community looked to her like a good way to get one. Well, thought George as he packed his one travel bag, it was fun while it lasted. He told her he'd introduce her to a few prospectors. Some of them might need a propulsion engineer. Still, he felt sad about the affair. "I've been manipulated," he realized. Then, despite himself, he broke into a rueful grin.
"She's pretty good at manipulating," he had to admit.
Once his travel bag was zipped up, George instructed the ship's computer to display any messages waiting for him. The wall screen instantly showed a long list. He hadn't been paying attention to his duties for the past several days, he knew.
Being a chief administrator means being a mediator, a decision maker, even a father confessor to everyone and anyone on the fucking belt, he grumbled silently.
One message, though, was from Pancho Lane. Surprised and curious, George ordered her message on screen. The computer displayed a wavering, eye-straining hash of colored streaks. Pancho's message was scrambled. George had to pull out his personal palm comp and hunt for the combination to de-scramble it. At last, Pancho's lean, lantern-jawed face filled the screen.
"Hi, George. Sorry we didn't get to spend more time together before you had to take off. Let me ask you a question. Can you contact Lars if you need to? I might have to talk to him."
The screen went blank. George stared at it thoughtfully, wondering,
"Now why in all the caverns of hell would Pancho need to talk to Lars Fuchs?"
Hell Crater. Pancho always grinned when she thought about Father Maximilian J. Hell, the Jesuit astronomer for whom this 30-kilometer-wide lunar crater had been named. Wily promoters such as Sam Gunn had capitalized on the name and built a no-holds-barred resort city at Hell Crater, complete with gambling casinos and euphemistically named honeymoon hotels. Astro Corporation had made a fair pocketful of profits from building part of the resort complex, but Pancho wasn't visiting Hell to check on corporate interests. She had received a message from Amanda to meet her at the medical center there. Mandy's message had come by a tortuously circuitous route, embedded in a seemingly innocuous invitation to Cellini's annual Independence Day celebration, sent by none other than Douglas Stavanger. Ever since the Christmas party, Pancho had been trying to see Amanda, to renew the friendship that had come to a screeching halt once Mandy had married Humphreys. Amanda replied politely to each of Pancho's invitations, but somehow always had an excuse to postpone a meeting. Mandy had never replied in real time. Her messages were always recorded. Pancho studied Amanda's face each time, searching for some hint of how Mandy was and why she wouldn't, or more likely couldn't, get away from Humphreys long enough to have lunch with an old pal. So when Stavanger's video invitation popped up on Pancho's screen, she was staggered to see his youthful face morph into Amanda's features.
"Please meet me at the Fossil Medical Center, Pancho, next Wednesday at 11:30.
Then her image winked out, and Doug Stavanger's was smiling at her again. Pancho couldn't recapture Mandy's message either. It was gone completely. Curiouser and curiouser, Pancho thought, as she rode the cable car from Cellini. The cable lines were the cheapest and most efficient transportation system on the moon. Rockets were faster, and there was a regular rocket shuttle between Cellini and the growing astronomical observatory complex at Farside. But the cable cars ran up and over the Alphonsus Ringwall Mountains and out to Copernicus, Hell, and the other budding centers being built on the moon's near side. There were even plans afoot to link Cellini with the bases being built in the lunar South Pole region by cable systems. A corporate executive of Pancho's stature could have commandeered a car for herself, or even flown over to Hell in her own rocket hopper, but that wasn't Pancho's style. She enjoyed being as inconspicuous as possible, and found it valuable to see what the ordinary residents of Cellini, the self-styled lunatics, were thinking and doing. Besides, she didn't want to call the attention of Humphrey's ever-present spies to the fact she was going, literally, to Hell. So she whizzed along 20 meters above the flat, pockmarked, rock-strewn surface of Mare Nubium, wondering what Amanda was up to. The cable car's interior was almost exactly like a spacecraft's passenger cabin, except that Pancho could feel it swaying slightly as she sat in her padded chair.